This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your time with us today. We are talking with author Ron Rindo about his latest book, Life and Death and Giants. Ron is an emeritus professor of English and creative writing at UW Oshkosh. He's published one previous novel, which we talked about a few years back, Breathing Lake Superior. He's also written three short story collections. And as we talked to Ron, we want to hear from you. So let us know why you love Ron's writing. What have you read Life and Death and Giants? What do you think about it? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Ron, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back, Joe. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure because this book is wonderful, and I don't just say that. So,
well, thank you.
It really, really is good. And let's start off with the title of your book, okay?
Yes.
This is from a poem from Emily Dickinson, and you've got her poetry kind of sprinkled around throughout the book. What is it about her poetry that moved you to put it in the book, and specifically the title, especially?
Right. So I have loved Emily Dickinson for most of my career. I have taught her poetry at various levels in English classes. And it's just something that I wanted to engage with in this book. And so Hannah, the main character, one of the main characters, she is an Amish grandmother who, up until the point where she encounters Emily Dickinson's poetry, has only read religious texts, specifically the Bible. And when she discovers this collected book of Emily Dickinson poems in her mother's trunk after her mother passes away, it's what begins her journey into the secular world, into the world of culture. And it's the first step, and she's entranced by it. And what entrances her is pretty much the same thing that has entranced me about Emily Dickinson, is that it's the way in which she covers so many different subjects. And her poems, particularly for Hannah's purposes, her poems about faith and doubt. And that really is what Hannah zeroes in on, and she finds it just entrancing, and she just cannot stop digging into that trunk and getting that book out, particularly at moments in her life that are, that she finds challenging.
Very comforting for her.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
And is part of that because it's her mother who cherished it?
Yes. And what's wonderful for Hannah is her mother has written little comments and notes. And so those are the poems that she seeks out because she knows her mother in one way. She knows her mother's outside life, but she hasn't had that in-depth exposure to her mother's inside life, you know, the intimate interior life. And she's both shocked and really happy to be able to encounter that because she's someone who's also very introspective as a character, as a person.
Sure. Let's tell us the kind of the overview of the book itself before we get too far into it, so people kind of know what we're talking about.
Sure. So Life and Death and Giants, it's centered on a young Amish boy who was born into this small community called Lakota, Wisconsin. It's based on Dakota, Wisconsin, a place that I have trout fished many, many times in my life on the McCann River. And there are four characters who tell the story of this young boy who is born into this community, and he grows up ultimately to be just under 9 feet tall, and he weighs 600 pounds. He is based upon, his growth is based upon the largest human being who's ever been recorded, a man named Robert Wadlow, who lived in the 1930s and 40s. He's also known as the Alton Giant. He grew to be 9 feet tall, 600 pounds. He had size 37 feet. But unlike Gabriel in the book, who is very talented athletically, Robert Wadlow, because of his large size, he had to wear leg braces and he had lots of physical problems. He worked for the circus for a while. He also worked as a representative for a shoe company that custom made his size 37 shoes. But he, one of the braces rubbed against his ankle and he got an infection and he died at the age of 22 of that infection. So that's where the initial idea for the story came from. In this story, then, Gabriel's life is told by four different narrators. The main one, I think, was probably his Amish grandmother, Hannah Fisher, who helps to raise him for a portion of his life. Then there's the veterinarian named Thomas Kennedy, who delivers him from his dying mother. He weighs 18 pounds when he's born, and he's 27 inches long. So he's very, very
large.
And
he basically bursts out of his mother.
Yes, yes. He has to use a lambing snare to pull him from his mother's body. And then there's a football coach by the name of Trey Beathard, who has come up from Texas, and he coaches his high school football team, and ultimately he is the person that brings Gabriel out of the sort of safety of the Amish community and into the wider world as a football star. And then finally, there's Billy Walton, who is the owner of a local sports bar, who coaches Gabriel in Little League. He sponsors a Little League team, and he's a sports fanatic. And a little salty in his language and his view of the world, and somewhat provides some of the comic relief. But those are the four characters who tell Gabriel's story from birth and until the end of the book.
One thing I really wanted to ask you as I was reading through this. So three of the narrators aren't first person, but the veterinarian is not. So why did you do that, Ron?
Yes, that's a very good question. So one of the pleasures of writing short stories is you get to create these voices and you inhabit this first person who can be very different than you are. And that's certainly true for the three narrators in this story. For Thomas, for the veterinarian, I also needed a little extra room to be sometimes to be omniscient. So even in the prologue, it's in Thomas's point of view, but there are moments when the narrator has to sort of tell the story of the larger town or some of the other characters and so forth. And so I needed that extra space. And I worried about that just a little bit, but really with a couple of exceptions, no one has really, you know, said too much about that being a problem.
It's not a problem, but it was a question.
It is, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It is. It was deliberate, but it's definitely something that I think it's wise to notice.
Well, I try. So now let's talk about this, the inspiration that you had for this. I love the fact that you write in the beginning that you kind of had this idea in your head, but it just wasn't gelling.
Yes.
So what did it take?
Yeah, so I was reading about Robert Wadlow one day sitting at my desk eating lunch. And
as one does.
As one does. And I was trying to figure out, I wanted to write a story about a giant in 21st century America. And so I wrote a version of the prologue. The version in the book is about the fifth draft right now. But, you know, the birth scene and this giant is born. But there were two problems. One, I didn't really know where the story was going to go. That was the main thing. Like, okay, so you're going to have a giant. I suspected if you're going to be 9 feet tall today, you would probably play sports of some kind. And so I kind of knew all that. But one of the stickier points that it bothered me was I didn't think it would be possible for someone to become a giant today because medical intervention would have made that, you know, they could treat it, right? Any kind of pituitary problem. And so I was fishing on the McCann River and an Amish buggy went by. And I had written this prologue probably 2 or 3 years earlier. It was just sitting in a file, you know, and I had moved on to other short stories or working on some other things. And an Amish buggy went by. You see a lot of Amish buggies in that part of the state. And for some reason, it made me start thinking again about this novel. And I thought, well, if this young boy was born into an Amish community where they don't necessarily vaccinate their children or go to the doctor on a regular basis, remember the big measles outbreak in Texas was started in a Mennonite community for the same reason. So I went back to it then. I thought, okay, this person is going to be Amish. And then, of course, serendipitously, other things started to unfold, and that was one of the main tensions in the book, which is between the secular life and the spiritual life,
right,
and the desire to live a life devoted to community and humility and just the quiet sort of life of an Amish person versus the American quest for individual fame and fortune, mm-hmm. which is going to find you if you become 9 feet tall. And
they
that's going to be
it.
Spread around the world via social media. And so it just it solved one problem, and it also introduced the main sort of thematic thread that runs mm-hmm. through the book.
And I just realized that Hannah's last name is Fisher. Was that intentional?
That's my mother's maiden name.
Oh, okay.
And it's also a fairly prominent Amish name as well.
It is. Well, that works out really well.
It did.
So let's talk about another name, which is the name of this giant, which is Gabriel. Mm-hmm. Very biblical in background. Did you do that on purpose, too?
I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did on purpose. His mother is Amish, but she has been cast away from her community for bearing a child out of wedlock and for not naming the father and refusing to name the father. That causes a lot of angst for her mother, obviously, who is separated from her daughter and not able to attend to the birth of her first child, who is Jasper Fisher. And when he's 17 is when she delivers, when she gives birth to Gabriel. So Hannah, even though Rachel has been cast out of her community, she's still a woman of deep faith. And so she names her son Gabriel.
Uh-huh. And yeah, he's definitely a messenger, right?
Yes, he is.
Yes, he is. When you do names, obviously you said this was your mother's last name, and how important is it to you that it's not that you just like the name, but that it has some kind of underlying meaning, not only to you, but to one of the readers?
I think sometimes, probably most times, I think that's true. So for an example, Billy Walton, the name of the bar owner, that's actually the name of my great uncle, who was not a bar owner. He was a butcher, but he had a very extensive bar in his basement. And he spoke a lot like Billy Walton in this novel. He's long passed away. So that's an example of that.
Sure.
The name Thomas's mother's name is my own mother's name, Dorothy. So sometimes I use names that are familiar. Mm-hmm. My three granddaughters' names are in the book as well. Sometimes I just drop names in like that for fun.
We can't help that.
Gabriel and then Raphael, those are both important names, and they're drawn from the biblical.
Yes, which makes sense. We are talking with Ron Rindo. He's the author of Life and Death and Giants. Do you have any questions about the novel? Do you have questions for Ron about his writing? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us because at noon today, we're going to talk to the artistic director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. We'll get some updates about their new space in downtown Milwaukee, hear about their upcoming season. But first, we are talking to Ron Rindo, the author of Life and Death and Giants. So, Ron, we talked a little bit about Hannah. Why don't you read an excerpt from your book? And this is in... from her.
Sure. Right. So Hannah is, she's lives on a farm, clearly, and she's outdoors in her garden and with her animals on a regular basis. So this is a chapter it's about two-thirds of the way through, and she's about to have a walk with her sister, who's visiting for her father's funeral, and they're about to have a very difficult conversation. So she's just reminiscing about the fall, September in Wisconsin, and so since it is September, and the beauty of the September is a big part of this short passage. It also gives you a sense of Hannah's introspection. All my life, autumn has been my favorite time of year. By mid-September, jars of fruits and vegetables filled our pantry shelves to sagging. Hundreds of carrots and potatoes nestled in the sand of our root cellar. Hay to last the winter had been cut, baled, and stacked in the barn. The mornings were cold and still. I would rise long before Josiah and dress in the dark. As early light washed the night gray, I would pull on my boots and slip out the door. I'd tread the road away from my father's house, out of sight of my still sleeping goats, walking the half mile to a pasture we'd left fallow for years, bounded by the river and back an overgrown hedgerow on two sides, 5 acres gone to wild beauty. It is one of my favorite places. I would enter the field just as sunlight began to color the earth, my boots following deer trails through the tall grass. I'd smile at the impressions of their delicate feet in the earth, like a string of small broken hearts. At that time of year, goldenrod is in bloom. Lacy stands of staghorn sumac have gone red, the seed horns a beacon for cardinals and chickadees. Along the far hedgerow, a flock of cedar waxwings might weave through the hawthorns, gorging on the tiny red fruit. My dress would grow heavy and wet along the bottom where it was mottled with cockle burrs and brambles, and I would marvel at the Lord's genius in making me, like the wind and birds, a sower of the seeds of his bounty. Alone with my thoughts, I often reproach myself for shameful jealousies, bewildering moments of vanity, inexplicable impatience, retching anger with Josiah. It troubled me that age and experience had not ameliorated my imperfections. If anything, when I examined the arc of my life, I found that thoughts or actions I at one time would have avoided for fear of damnation, I now engaged with only minimal worry or none at all.
It's lovely, perfect for today, even though it's very warm outside. But yeah, oh, that's gorgeous. Thank you for sharing that with us. Your descriptions are so well done. How do you know when you've gone far enough, and how do you know when you've not gone far enough with descriptions?
Yeah, that's a tricky thing for all writers, you know. So you're either Balzac, I'll use French writers, who just would have gone page upon page upon page, right? Or the writer of Madame Bovary, who would have just given you, you know, one or two or three, what he called, right, le mot juste, the right, the right word. You know, you're making a movie in your reader's mind, right? So you want them to be able to see and hear and smell and, you know, the world that you created, but you also want to continue to move the narrative forward. So it's always a bit of a juggling act, you know. The pacing of this book is, it's not the pacing of a thriller or, you know, a mystery. It has a more leisurely pace that goes with its thematic focus, I think, and with the sort of the atmosphere of the place, right? Yeah. This rural Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's like timing in a song and music. It's got a steady beat that keeps going and just unfolds as it goes. So we talked about Hannah a little bit. Let's talk about Billy Walton. Okay, so we know he's a bar owner. I love the name of the bar, Shaken Not Stirred.
Shaken Not Stirred, yes.
Tell us about Billy. He's had an interesting background.
Yeah, he does. So Billy, because he grew up in a bar, right? He grew up in one of these places where the bar is downstairs and the apartment upstairs is where he lived with his parents. He was an only child. And starting around the age of 12, he started putting beer into his soda cup. And he would be down in the bar, and he gradually becomes an alcoholic. And that really troubles his life for up through his 20s into his 30s. Gets married twice. He has children by both of his wives. He gets divorced. He loses custody of his children and gradually loses touch with his children. So he loves sports. It's a sports bar. He coaches Little League, but he has a heart attack off the page. And so he has to quit drinking, and he does quit drinking. But he loves sports, and he falls in love with Gabriel. And when he starts to coach him as a little boy and really wants him to continue playing baseball, when his brother Jasper dies and Gabriel is taken in by his Amish grandparents, who he starts to wear Amish clothing, he starts to work on the farm and becomes schooled in an Amish school, Billy really is upset about it because he wants him to continue playing. And so when Gabriel suddenly shows up on the football team at age 17, Billy is overjoyed. And he, decorates his entire bar with the high school colors. And so he tells the story of Gabriel from the point of view of someone who's a sports fanatic and who really wants him to succeed as an athlete because it just gives him great joy. And that love for Gabriel really starts to change him too because he becomes a little bit softer, a little bit more open to relationships with other people and ultimately finds himself in a relationship with a woman that he loves, which he says, I didn't expect this to happen. I don't know how this happened.
I love the way they connect.
Yes.
That's really, really sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. He stopped to change the tire of a car. Estelle Smith says she's been widowed when her husband dies. And
which
he has
trouble.
I don't
mean to laugh, but the way the poor guy dies.
Yes. Well, he's at a New Year's Eve party and it's 20 below. It's a Wisconsin, and he's drunk, he's driving home, and his car breaks down, and he gets out of the car to walk home 3 miles, and it's 25 below, and of course he freezes to death.
Yes, and you say that way in the beginning, and then I'm like, who's this person again? Oh, that's right. Oh, poor lady. Yeah.
Right, she shows up, but yeah, at the end.
She shows up at the end.
Oh, okay,
yes,
that's what
she shows up at the end. Okay, so we've got Billy, and then let's talk about let's go to Trey first, who's the football coach. And he's got a really interesting background, too.
Yeah, so Lakota is made up of these people who have been there for a long time. But there are also some people who have come from other places. And Thomas has come up from Milwaukee, the veterinarian. And Billy has been there. Hannah has been there. But Trey comes up from Texas. And so he has come the farthest, but he has been a college football coach, a big-time football coach. He has been recruiting all over the country. He has been used to coaching these really first-rate five-star athletes. But at the same time, he is also an addict himself. And so when his life implodes, he loses his job, he loses his family. His aunt owns a horse farm up in Lakota. And when his family in Texas disowns him because of his behavior, she invites him to come up and live with her and her partner. And so he comes up from Texas and moves in and just works at a gas station and just tries to pull his life back together. And then one of his, I think it's his aunt or his aunt's partner, they see an ad for the football coach job after about a year, the local high school football coach, and he applies and gets the job. And so that's where he becomes enamored with Gabriel. He sees Gabriel out in the field with a couple of other Amish boys loading hay on a wagon, and he's throwing hay bales with one hand, 13 feet high, the top of, and he goes home and he gets on a scale with the bales of hay at this horse farm, and they weigh 45, 50 pounds. And he tries to throw one, and he can get it maybe 7-8 feet high. And he's, you know, a former linebacker, he's
sure.
A big guy. And he realizes that he has to try to talk this huge boy into coming and playing football for him. And he has to go and talk to his grandparents and convince them to let him play football.
Why was it important for this character to have that experience? It could have been just a local coach. Why did you have the experience?
Yeah, I wanted someone who was a really, really good coach. And someone, high school football in Texas is not high school football in Wisconsin.
No.
They're 20, 30,000 people show up to games there. The football coaches there are first rate. They know the game inside and out, and he's been a really good recruiter. But he also has to be humbled, right? He is humbled. He's coaching this tiny, this little middle of nowhere team after he just was coaching Division I, you know, college football. And so he's got this sort of ragtag group. He's got these linemen who are vomiting on the field when they get tired. And, you know, but he gradually puts together this team. The quarterback and one of the wide receivers are from Mexico. Their top running back has come over from Africa. And then there's Gabriel. And so they cobble together this amazing team. They go on ultimately to win the state championship.
Oh, you gave it away.
I did.
And the football scenes are really good. I mean, I like football. I'm a fan. But I think it's just enough where if someone who's reading it was maybe not, I think that they would get all of that without really getting into it.
Yeah, there have been some readers who say they kind of skip over some of the football
stuff.
They shouldn't. I had a lot more football in an earlier draft, and I cut a lot. But there is enough. I mean, football is one of my passions. You know, I always taught my students to put your passions in your work. It doesn't matter what they are. If you're passionate about it, readers will react to that. And so I've got Emily Dickinson here. I've got football. I've got trout fishing. I've got art, art museums. I've got reading literature. All of those things, I really, you know, I just kept putting them all in there.
Yeah. And you've got animals.
Oh, animals. Yes.
They play a very large role in this.
They do. Mm-hmm. They do. They play a really, really large role. So Gabriel, as a young boy, is modeled after my youngest son, who loved animals as well. We have pictures of Noah sitting on the porch.
And his name is Noah?
His name is Noah.
How appropriate is that?
Yes. And he was sitting on the porch as a little boy with maple syrup, one of our bantam roosters who would just sit on Noah's lap and Noah would feed him white bread. And then he would pet him and maple syrup would fall asleep on his lap.
Oh.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a book about, ultimately, it's a book about redemption, but also about community, right? And about how these people come from all these different places, and they're all very different backgrounds and very different religious beliefs and so forth. And animals are also part of that community for me. Animals and trees, you know, to know the names of things and to live with other living things the way in which these people do. Thomas is a veterinarian, right? Mm. He was devoted his life to caring for animals. My wife and I, for many years, we raised Shetland sheep, and we still have chickens. And one time, one of our sheep was down overnight. She was giving birth, and she could not do it. She had two really large ram lambs. And so in the morning, we went out there expecting to find her with two lambs, and she was still down. And so we had to call a veterinarian. And I tell you, those large animal veterinarians, it's very dangerous work. It's not nearly as remunerative as being a companion animal. And they just love animals so much, and they just do such incredible work. So I love that I could honor that, you know, that kind of work. When I was a boy, I kind of wanted to be a veterinarian, but I couldn't have handled the math and the science for sure. And so I get to be a veterinarian in a way and in this book.
It's kind of nice like that. Like we're going to be talking about theater in a little bit. Yes. And it's like the same thing. You get to pretend to be the things that you've always wanted to be.
Exactly. So, yes, yeah, for sure.
Very cool. All right. So our last character, and this is the one where we don't get the first person narrative. That's Thomas Kennedy, a veterinarian, mm-hmm. obviously. Tell us about him. He's got a lot of depth on this character.
Yeah, so Thomas is someone who's had a rough, his wife passed away under circumstances that some people, you know, believe that he was partly responsible for that. And so he, in a sense, and he's a very sensitive person, and he wasn't responsible, and yet he did cause her death. And so when he flees and ends up in Lakota, he just was trout fishing on this river and sees a house and decides this is a place where I should move. But he is someone who's haunted by this thing that happened to him. And he prefers the company of animals to the company of human beings. And because he's a veterinarian, he meets all of these people, not just the sort of what the Amish call the English, right, the farmers, but also the Amish themselves. And so he is one of these characters who is exposed to everyone, right? And all that. What I tried to do with this story is braid together these relationships to show how community forms. And so Thomas is someone who is connected to pretty much everyone because of the nature of his work. And he's also agnostic, which is interesting, because his interactions with Hannah, which get more and more in depth as the novel goes on, introduces that tension, right? So even though he's agnostic, he is also extraordinarily kind. And she tells him at one point, she said, "You have done more for the people, for animals and for everyone than any 100 other people have been," even though he's not strictly a believer in her sense, and someone probably she shouldn't even be interacting with according to her faith. So he has to go it's wrong to say it's against his faith, but he has to work with people who are devoutly, devoutly religious, and does so and finds them marvelous to work with, and vice versa, right? And so the kinds of things that unfortunately divide so many Americans today aren't things that divide the people in this community. They find their ways through and around those things. And it's all about the way in which they care for one another and they care for other living things in their community.
That's one thing that really caught my eye, too, is that he tells, Hannah and her husband how he feels, you know, what his beliefs are, and he accepts theirs for what they are. They accept his, and neither mm-hmm. one tries to change the other.
Right.
But they do come together because they all love this boy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Gabriel, the metaphor I've used in other conversations, he's like the sun. And all of these other characters are the planets that are circling him. Like he's, in a sense, his gravitational force, and I guess that's not the sun, the way the sun works, but he draws them all to him and thus also to one another. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's their love for him which makes them see through all of the differences and see beyond the differences, because they all have this very common denominator. And the way in which he has lived his life, right, also has... You know, Hannah goes one direction, right? And Thomas kind of goes the other. I mean, Hannah goes from only reading religious books to moving out beyond that. She starts with Dickinson, but then she has this whole library ultimately available to her. She reads Zora Neale Hurston, and she reads Aeneas Nin, and those are things that she realized. And then she goes to the Art Institute in Chicago.
Oh, that was great.
And so, you know, there are things in the English world that she finds so entrancing, and she can't go back. She uses that metaphor, you know, you can't put the pumpkin back into the seed.
That was great.
And yet she has to try,
Yeah. Now, how did you learn about the Amish community and what happens behind closed doors?
So, first of all, Hannah, her character, she's based on a Puritan poet by the name of Anne Bradstreet, who struggled with her own faith at times. And she wrote these beautiful poems where she is trying to be this perfect Puritan woman. Now, the Puritans come out of, they both come out of the 17th century Reformation, the Puritans and the Amish, but slightly different. There's a beautiful poem that Anne Bradstreet writes called Here Follow Some Lines Upon the Burning of Our House, 1650, where her house burns down and she loses all her books and all of her furniture and all these beautiful things. And you cannot replace those things, right, in 17th century New England. And she is so sad about it. And she wanders through the ashes and just bemoans the loss of all of these things and comes at the very end of the poem. She says, "The world no longer let me love. My hope and treasure lies above." And no one believes that she really believes that at that point, right? She loves all of these things, you know? And so with Hannah, she comes out of the Anabaptist tradition, but it's the same where your earthly life is really supposed to be just transitory and you're supposed to be living for this other world, right? This other life. And that's how Amish live their lives, right? The earthly life is really of almost no consequence. That your desire is eternity. And so everything you do on earth is focused on the afterlife, right? And so your life is almost irrelevant in some ways. But like Anne Bradstreet, that's not how things work for her. She loves her animals. She loves nature. She loves Gabriel. She loves her daughter, right, with such great passion. And she's trying to figure out how she can honor her faith while also pursuing these more secular loves. She goes to the museum, right? She loves books. And so she's torn in this really complicated way, trying to honor her faith, but also, you know, follow the dictates of her heart. And so she, for me, is my favorite character by far. She's so introspective and so thoughtful and so humble. And she arrives at conclusions only after much thought. But also acknowledges her own fallibility all the way through. I mean, she's such a wonderful person. I just find her, you know, someone to aspire to, really, because she brings out just so much goodness in others and around her, and is constantly in a struggle for that goodness herself.
Mm-hmm. I think the scene where she, well, many times, but the first time she goes out in the middle of the night and she just watches, her daughter happens to be across the river and she can see what's going on and just stands there and for hours.
Yeah.
And she does that night after night.
Yeah, that's her first test really is, you know, Rachel refuses to name the father and so she is sent away from the community and shunning an Amish life is not, doesn't happen that often, but this is strang by dung. This is strong shunning because she has violated pretty substantial Amish rules. And so her parents have to let her live elsewhere, and they're not allowed to interact with her. And she is the mother, right? She wants to be present when she gives birth to Jasper, but she cannot be. And another woman takes her in. She lives across the river. She can see the house from her house. And she would get up in the middle of the night and go look out the kitchen window. She'd make up reasons. Oh, I have to get a drink or something. And finally, she can take it no more. And she literally, in the snow, she tromps out there with a chair and sits down to get closer. And her daughter is walking her baby back and forth these open windows. She can see these. Well, not they're not open, but they're lit. And she can see that. And she just wants to be with her daughter, but she wants to honor her faith. And, I mean, that is just a huge conflict, right? A huge interpersonal or personal conflict.
Definitely. We are talking with Ron Rindo. He's the author of the new book, Life and Death and Giants. If you have any comments or questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can also send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. Today we're talking about the novel Life and Death and Giants. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about wildlife with Scott Craven. And then we're going to hear about how antibiotic pollution might be harming amphibians. That's tomorrow starting at 11. Larry will be back to take you through that. But right now we're talking with Ron about his really good new book. Again, if you've got any questions or if you've read some of Ron's other work, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. We always like to talk with you. So, Ron, let's talk about location. So it's Wisconsin and very, very rural. What is it about that location that you wanted to share with your readers?
Well, it, you know, even though it's Lakota, I mean, it's based on Dakota, Wisconsin. And so most of the towns that are named in the book around Lakota are actual towns.
Right.
In fact, when we drive through Oxford on our way west across the state on Highway 82, I always point my wife to the BP station. I mean, that's where Trey worked when he came up from Texas.
That's
what I had in mind.
Uh-huh.
You know, what I tell students always, you know, is where you are is who you are. And for me, Wisconsin, specifically rural Wisconsin, where I live in rural Wisconsin, it's so much a part of who I have become. And I was born and raised in Wisconsin as well. And that involves everything, right? It involves the type of trees we have, the type of wildflowers and the grasses, the type of animals we see on a regular basis, our weather, right? The summers, the migrating geese and the migrating cranes. All those things are in this book, because I consider them part of our community, as I've said, and so for me, you know, place is so important to who these people are, and to how the novel moves forward, right? That they're all in the same shared space, and they all are surrounded by the same things, and their interactions with one another, and their interactions with the nature and wildlife and their gardens, all of that to me is part of what it means to live here.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make sure that was, you know, sort of totally imbued in the atmosphere of the novel.
It is. You definitely are there when you're reading it.
Thank you.
We've got a question or a comment actually from Pam in Altoona. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi, I'm so excited to have come across you on the radio when I just turned it on. I absolutely adored your new book. It's one of my favorites that I read. I got an early copy of it, and I thought it was absolutely phenomenal. And one of the things, well, there are a lot of things I loved about it, but it features so many key aspects of Wisconsin that I think anyone who's ever lived or gone through Wisconsin is going to relate to either one of the settings or the sports aspect or the Badger football that comes in. And the Amish, it just has so many different things. One of the things I'm curious about is that the ending of the book has some magical realism components with the way nature and animals kind of react at the very end. And I'm wondering, what made you decide to put that in?
Well, first of all, Pam, thank you so much for reading and for seeing all that Wisconsin in there. Yes, you're absolutely right. The Badgers are here. All right. Gabriel plays for the Badgers, and we actually beat Ohio State in this book. So I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, but it happens here. So the scene you're talking about, it's interesting to me. A lot of people have read that scene and you know, said the same thing about it. Personally, I don't think about it as magical. And I've said this in other contexts too. I think of it as mysterious, and it's a slightly different way to view it because, you know, Thomas and Hannah have different reactions, right? Hannah believes in miracles, and she absolutely thinks it is one. Whereas Thomas says, you know, scientists, when they don't understand something, and there's a lot of stuff in nature scientists do not understand. And so for me, it is a very mysterious, yes, it's kind of magical. I don't disagree with that. But I'm not working in sort of the vein of Gabriel Garcia Marquez at all. It's just that moment. I mean, I guess there are two things. One, as an 18-pound baby is stretching the bounds of reality somewhat. And then that scene, yes, the interactions of the animals and the birds and the insects in particular really are unusual. But I am sort of Thomas on that point. He's sort of doubting Thomas, right? Whereas Hannah clearly is unmistakably saying that was a miracle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love that you brought that up.
Thank you, Pam. We really appreciate that. And also thank you for not revealing too much about the ending. We don't want to spoil it for anybody. But I think it was one of those things where the probability is very rare for that to happen, but mm-hmm. it could happen, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 0.0001% chance, probably. But yeah, and when I was writing that, when I sat down to write that scene, I didn't intend for that to happen. It just happened. You know, I just started, and it just got to be more and more and more. You know, and it harkens back to Gabriel's birth scene, mm-hmm. Where he's born, and in response to his crying, you know, squirrels start chattering, coyotes start to howl.
Yeah.
You know, farm animals farther away start to bellow. And so his connection to those animals and to that life starts at birth, and it's still there.
What is it that these animals see or feel in Gabriel?
I think it's his size, ultimately, when he gets to be larger. But it's also his care for them. You know, cats and dogs, to go to domestic pets, they can tell when people are good people.
True.
They go to mm-hmm. some people and they stay away from others. And I don't know if it's how we move or, you know, how we interact with the world. But, you know, I think for Gabriel, in his sense, people and the animals are drawn to him. And so it makes sense that, you know, even, you know, as his life goes forward and you know, rough things start to happen to him, mm-hmm. that is the one constant that remains.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So how did you learn how to write?
I wanted to be a writer ever since I learned how to read.
Really?
I did. And, you know, when I started reading books, I kept a little notebook under the mattress of my bed, and I wrote short stories when I was a kid.
I love it.
And the only story I remember is called The Blind Colt. It was about a little boy who has a horse, and a cougar scratches the horse's eyes. I had never seen a cougar. I'd never been on a horse, you know, and I think I wouldn't have said it this way. But for me, I think I recognized early on that I wasn't going to be satisfied with the finiteness of a single life. And reading takes you outside of yourself, right? It moves you to places and people that you otherwise would never encounter in your single finite life. And so the same pleasures that I get from reading, I get from writing as well. And so, you know, I wanted to be a writer. And then what really cemented it is I went to a small Catholic school, third and fourth grade. We were in the same third grade and fourth grade in the same classroom. And we had this teacher named Mrs. Pritchett. And we'd go out for recess after lunch. And we'd come in, we'd be all sweaty. And of course, you know, still kind of antsy. And she would read to us out loud every single day for about 20 minutes after lunch. And she read Charlotte's Web and Little House on the Prairie and Little House in the Big Woods, which are both Wisconsin books,
yes,
by the way. And I was just, that was my favorite part of the day. And I just, from that moment on, I was like, I'm going to be a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I the teachers that read or that assigned us books, unlike most students, I guess, I was thrilled and enthralled. Yes. And thank you. And, you know, I've read since I was little, too. My parents, yes. My mom read to me all the time. It's so important. But like you said, you can travel. You can create the world that
right.
you're traveling in.
And you can
in.
Be so many different people, right? Yeah. You transcend your own identity, your own gender, your own race. You can do those things. Mm-hmm. I can be a veterinarian. I can be a football coach. I can be an Amish grandmother, right?
Absolutely. So it's been kind of a whirlwind. We had chatted earlier where you've been doing a lot of appearances and book readings, etc.
I have. It's been really fun.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed it. I also have been talking to some folks who have podcasts. I'm doing another one of those soon. Book clubs, online book clubs. I have one coming up on October 7th with a bookstore in Ohio.
That's great.
So it's been really enjoyable to talk with people about the book and to hear from folks.
And I was looking through Real Simple Magazine not too long ago, and they always have a page with the books they recommend. And I always kind of look at the end papers because I can, it's like, do we have those at our... And I saw yours.
I know. It's been, I tell you, the publicity folks, everyone I've worked with at St. Martin's Press, they've been just so amazing. Yeah, we were in a Real Simple magazine, and then this week we're in People magazine.
You are? Yes. Oh, I didn't see that. But you were in Milwaukee magazine, too.
Milwaukee magazine, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And then, you know, Kirkus and Publishers Weekly and all those places. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of been a little embarrassing to see this all over
Well, you are a Midwestern boy, right?
I know, it's true.
Difficult.
It's true.
But that's it's great and it's kind of scary at the same time, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is.
So what happens next now? Are you writing something?
I am. Mm-hmm. I am. I'm working on another novel. And so I just, not very far into it, probably mm-hmm. about 50 pages. And it's also a polyphonic novel. It has, but in this case, just three different narrators.
Okay.
And it's set in contemporary America, like, Right now.
So much to work with.
Yes, there's a lot to work with, actually. Yeah, the main character is a Catholic priest who's not a very good Catholic and not a very good priest, but an amazing person, and his twin sister.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
And their desire to smuggle some refugees into the country through Canada.
Okay. Yeah, well, that sounds very good. So you make sure that we get on that list for those advanced reading copies.
Of course.
Talk a little bit about your process now. Do you have a bunch of things that you've jotted down over the years, or do you kind of focus in on one thing and kind of stick with that till it's done?
Yeah, for most of my life, I've worked on multiple things at the same time, which is very common for short story writers in particular. And for most of my career, I was a short story writer. Mm-hmm. My wife and I were raising five kids. I had a job in the academy where you have to publish on a fairly regular basis. And, you know, just doing novels was not something that I just could work out, you know. But now the kids are out of the house and I have a lot more time so I can focus just on a single thing. I like to write in the mornings when I'm more awake and alert. And sometimes that'll stretch later into the early afternoon, or sometimes not. I just focus on one narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the tricks that I've discovered, I mean, my first book is just a really long short story, ultimately. Breathing Lake Superior is like a short story that got
fairly short,
out of hand, and it's just one narrator. But with Life and Death and Giants and with the new novel, you know, I get the pleasures of writing short stories where you create characters who have distinct voices, and then I weave those separate stories together. The new novel, I think the stories are going to be more separate, sort of like a Robert Stone novel, A Flag for Sunrise, title also came from Emily Dickinson, where he has like three separate narratives going, and then at some point, maybe halfway or two-thirds, they come together. I think that's what I'm going to try to do here. He always said he learned to write novels from Joseph Conrad, so maybe Conrad's novels do that as well. But I'm going to focus on one thing and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a board up with all of your ideas and
information? I don't, but I usually have to keep track in a notebook, like with Life and Death and Giants. There's so many characters, and trying to keep the narrative and the chronology straight and so forth. That part is a little more complicated.
Because if you don't, your readers are going to tell you, right?
They will. They'll say, wait a minute, this doesn't work.
Wait a second. Yes. So would you consider yourself an observer of life?
I think so.
Okay.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, there's always this tension in writers' lives between the desire to be out and about in the world and then the requirement to be sitting still in one place outside of, you know, that. I think I pay attention, and I think, you know, I learned to do that when I was a boy. Mm-hmm. Even though I love to be around people and I love community and I love conversation, there's a strong part of me that still likes to just be alone or to just be on the watch, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're just watching and paying attention and trying to learn things.
Yeah.
I mean, I think as I get older, it's interesting. As you get older, even though you know more, you get more humble. And you just become so much more aware of the complexities and the gray areas of life. And those are the things I think that make for really good fiction.
They do, for sure. And you are just, you can just tell by your personality, you're calm, you're still, but you definitely are an observer. So mm-hmm. do you think that that's something that someone is out there who really maybe wants to write, needs to kind of step back a little bit and do?
I totally think that's right. I mean, I always quote Annie Dillard, right? Annie Dillard says, in the physical world, the greatest absorbers are also the greatest emitters, right? So blacktop absorbs heat, and it puts out the heat. And I think for people, I think that metaphor works.
I love it. Well, Ron, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I really appreciate you writing this book and for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much, Jill. I love being here with you.
Wonderful. Ron Rindo is the author of Life and Death and Giants. And if you do anything today, it's find this book. Get it at your library. Check it out. But you need to read it. Thank you.